Well, hello there, Wandering Tech Podcast listener. Lydia here. It only felt fitting for me to have the chance to do something, whilst not as exciting as Paul Harris walking around the wonderful countryside that he lives nearby, but for the chance to introduce another interview that we had the chance to record earlier on last year. I had a fantastic opportunity to spend almost 2 hours actually talking to the one and only Amanda Bertucci. Me and Amanda had the chance to meet back at DemoFest a couple of years back, and I have been so incredibly lucky that since then been able to call her a dear friend of mine. Amanda is one of these people who is absolutely not afraid to take on complicated, complex, and potentially controversial topics as well. And it's one of the many reasons why I absolutely adore the conversations we had back then. Today's episode is pretty much split up into very distinct halves. The first part is about our common background with infrastructure pre-sales, our journeys there, and the potential differences between how is infrastructure pre-sales looking like today versus SaaS pre-sales, and a lot of really interesting tidbits here and there. And the second part is about diversity inclusivity within the pre-sale space. I would really encourage for folks to not skip either. I want to caveat that both of these conversations are very including. It's not about, oh, if you're not an infrastructure person, you should not listen to the first part. Actually, quite the opposite. I think it's very interesting to see what it's like on the other side of the fence of other colleagues that you might have within your own teams that have come from that background, or people that you're talking to outside in the big LinkedIn space. And when it comes to diversity and inclusivity, it's a very hot topic at the moment. I truly believe that the changes that are happening in the world right now should not impact how we behave with our fellow human. And I'll be honest with you, the conversation I had with Amanda is one of the most refreshing ones I've personally listened to, quite interestingly now, maybe, you know, a couple of months later on. I've listened to it as a first-time listener because I had completely forgotten what we had discussed about. But it's a very frank and a very refreshing take on a lot of really complicated challenges that folks are facing in the workspace and specifically in the pre-sale space. Talking about Amanda herself, she's currently a senior sales engineer in Commvault. She has a 20-year career within the pre-sale space that she goes into a little bit of details during the interview itself. So I'll let her do all the talking. And at the end, I'll catch up with you again very briefly because unfortunately, I couldn't help myself when I was talking to Amanda. I do talk quite a lot during this interview. So I apologize in advance, but please enjoy.
So shall we talk about infrastructure pre-sales? Because it's a topic that you and I both adore. And it's something that we always like, just for listeners are aware, I did have the wonderful pleasure of actually visiting Amanda at one point. And I think we spent about like maybe 6 hours straight at one evening just talking about pre-sales on a terrace in Barcelona, which was amazing. Out of all the places in the world, just be talking about pre-sales. That is definitely magical.
Yes.
Shall we start with that? So obviously, like I've spoken about my background in when it comes to like VMware and like where does it stand in, from an infrastructure perspective. Can I get from you just a little bit shortly with your words? Where has your role been? How do you see that role has changed over like the different companies you've worked for? Have you always been in infrastructure or has there been like a little bit of a mix? Because for my example, like I did have a SaaS product, but it was still an infrastructure product, even though it was cloud services only. So it was still within that same, I would say, field. Talk me a little bit through your like infrastructure pre-sales journey and does it square at one point within SaaS?
So I started in data protection over 20 years ago. And I came from like technical support, professional services, all of that. And I went into pre-sales when pre-sales was kind of becoming a thing in the infrastructure world, right? Because usually you had like the professional services people doing the pre-sales role. And, you know, over 15 years ago, that's when I was invited to be part of a pre-sales team that was called pre-sales.
Yeah. So that has the actual title pre-sales.
Exactly. And I wasn't doing like the double role. I wasn't doing like the whole thing, like pre and post sales. So that has changed a lot because I've been mostly in data protection for a few years. I was also in cloud infrastructure. I do have a SaaS product I work with today. In my previous company, we also had some SaaS offerings. But, my DNA is infrastructure. It's changed a lot because we started incorporating practices into the infrastructure world that are probably very common on SaaS today. Like, you need to sell more, you need to sell faster, right? And the way that you approach the customers, it's very easy to get into the harbor tour when you work with infrastructure, right? Because your audience is very technical.
Yeah. And they want to see everything, right? Because they know they're getting a tool. So they want to know all of the settings. They want to know all of the functions and features that they have. They want to know all of the buttons and what do they do.
Exactly. And that's a huge trap.
Yeah.
Because you have to be very careful when you're narrowing down what you want to show and how you're positioning things. Otherwise, you just go into the rabbit hole and it just gets confusing and overwhelming for everyone. I think that this has been changing in the infrastructure world in the past few years. It's probably changing in a slower pace than SaaS world, I would say.
I would agree.
SaaS world is more dynamic and it's probably not as, well, it might be an unfair comment, but coming from my perspective, like we need to have such a broad knowledge. It's really easy to get lost in the details of things, you know. So just to give you an example, like working with data protection, I have to know about operating systems. I have to know about servers, like hardware, actual hardware. I have to have a deep knowledge in storage. I have to know more superficially about like different applications a customer can have, databases they might use, cloud, like hyperscalers, how the hyperscalers work, Kubernetes, different types of containers.
Say networking.
Networking, of course. You can talk about infrastructure without talking about networking, right?
There you go.
So you have to know the basics. You don't have to be like a super expert in everything, but you have to know a little bit of everything because these are the conversations you're going to be having with your customer. And when you're architecting a solution or when you're designing a solution, you need to have these details in mind. How many VLANs are involved? What kind of infrastructure is there? How are they interconnected? What is the bandwidth? What kind of servers they have? What type of disks their storage devices have? It's quite broad.
Yeah, I completely resonate with that. So from my experience, and it was unfortunately a sort of a negative experience. So when I first joined VMware, there was another lady that joined alongside with me. And the differences between both of us as associates coming into VMware was that I came from a technical background. So I used to be a network engineer before I joined VMware. She came in from a military background. So she had all of the customer-facing skills. She had that side of pre-sales tucked away. And it was really like the idea of my manager at the time was really to, for us as we're working together, sort of for that knowledge to bleed into each other a little bit. But then I think very quickly we realized that if that fundamental technological knowledge, to your point about knowing a little bit of servers, having touched a little bit of the data center design, having done networking, having done a little bit of security beforehand, having done a little bit of that, a little bit of this, was incredibly fundamental to a success as someone coming into this incredibly steep learning curve of becoming a pre-sales person within infrastructure. That unfortunately, like she didn't make that cut, right? So she decided to leave IT entirely, which was such a devastating blow to me, even personally, let alone to her. Because like looking at someone who like I was like my comrade coming into this field, it was just like, oh no, like, I could have done more. I could have done better to like help her. But it was later on, looking back at it now, it's more of a, there is so much prerequisite knowledge for someone to be within infrastructure pre-sales. And a question back to you, and something for me also to think about a little bit is it because of the prospects and customers that we're talking to? Is the expectation of us a little bit higher, potentially, than our SaaS counterparts? Or is it just our own, you know, an element of our own making? Did we cause this to ourselves because of the type of people that happen to be in infrastructure pre-sales?
This can have so many nuances because there is a thing about culture, right? About being the techie. It's something about the techie culture. Techies like to show how much they know, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of us pre-sales, we fall into that. We want to show the customer that we got it all figured out. And sometimes it's not the best path to go. Sometimes it's okay to say, hey, I'm not really an expert on this, but I know who to ask and I can come back with an answer for you. So I think there's a lot of that kind of techie ego thing that happens in infrastructure.
Yeah. Have you ever felt that like as an expectation from a customer, like that you need to be knowing this stuff if you're going to be talking to them about like data security?
I used to think so in the past few years, I've been kind of deconstructing that. I think there is a level of, you need to know a little bit about everything, but it's okay that I'm not an expert on everything. And I think that's quite big, because when I first started doing pre-sales within infrastructure, specifically with data protection, I had that in my head that I had to show that I knew everything, you know, that I was that tech guru that the customer could count on. And today I see it a little bit differently. There's like this foundational knowledge that we need to have, but at the same time, I don't need to show the customer that I know everything in depth. I need to show them that I know how to listen to them and that I can architect a solution that is going to solve their problems. And it seems like it's common sense, but sometimes it's very hard to understand that. You know, it's very hard to make that shift, especially when you come from, let's say, professional services, where you're just trying to, you're highly specialized in what you do, and you do that, you're hands-on like every day. But when you move into pre-sales, there are other things that you need to develop. And I think that customers value more like your ability to listen and understand them than showing your big book of certifications.
Yeah. By the way, like that part about the shift between switching from being, oh, I need to be the expert, to I am there to be the customer's perspective, let's say, internally, or like I'm there to be their voice in a way. I had to make that shift very quickly, because as I remember, it was about like the 9th, 10th month mark where I was like really deep into this idea of like, I need to be an expert. I need to know everything about the product. Like I was doing hands-on demos. Like I was breaking the product every other day for the sake of learning over and over, like, and going to the minutia. But then I would get onto a call with a customer who has been using the product for longer than I've even known about it. They've been using it for like plus years. And I'm just like, okay, I can never beat that. Right? I can never know more about the product that I am selling than this individual. So I had to like very quickly shift my mentality from, you don't have to know it all. You don't have to know everything about it. Because like, even if I spend all of my free time to do that, I still wouldn't know, even to your point, as much as a professional services person, because I don't do all of the implementations. I just talk about it all the time. So then it was exactly. Like, okay, then what is my value here, right? I had a real like crisis of identity. I'm like, okay, if I'm not the techie, if I'm not the techiest person on this call, then what is my point, right? And that was a really huge revelation about like, okay, then what is it that I do? And that's about where like my biggest shift happened as a pre-sales person, from just being the NSX person, right? From being like the security guy, the security person. I walked in going like, okay, I am your advocate now internally into VMware. I am here to listen exactly to you. I'm here to understand more about your vertical. I'm here to understand exactly about your infrastructure. Who are the other companies that you're using internally? What are the other things that you guys have? Map it all out and help you take it from, we need some, in my case, the use case was most likely the micro-segmentation, from we need micro-segmentation to you guys actually having a micro-segmentation solution in place. That was my role, but oh man, was that a shift. Also, it didn't help that at home, I have a network engineer in the other office that whenever, like when I made that shift mentally and I started learning more about sales, about pre-sales in particular, I was reading, the first book I ever read on the topic was Chris White's book.
Same, that was my first as well. Yeah.
So when I started reading these things and like talking to my partner about all of this stuff, he would turn around and go like, oh, so now you're a salesperson. It that just grinded my gears to, at the end, degree is like, no, I'm a techie. And it took me again, like a couple of months to like, oh no, actually it's okay. I am in technical sales. That's fine.
Yeah.
I'm not a filthy salesperson.
We have it in the title. Like,
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite humbling, actually, because you get into the thing, I want to be the expert, and then you think better than everyone. And then you go to the customer, and the customer knows more than you, and you're like, so what am I doing here? And that's exactly when you have to start listening. It's very humbling. For me, I think the biggest shift was, first of all, there were two situations. The first of them was moving into pre-sales leadership. That was like, for me, it was like starting over, because you just have to forget a lot about other things that you do on a daily basis and open up to learning new stuff. And that's all that detail that it doesn't really matter anymore. And then The second situation was moving from data protection to cloud infrastructure. It's still within the infrastructure world, but it was a completely different set of products, set of customers. I was working with, at the time, with MSPs. It's a different audience. It's a different approach. And it's very humbling to be like, okay, I'm 20 years into my career and I can learn something new. And I don't have to be like the biggest expert on this, but I need to be able to listen to my customer, architect the solution, have a conversation with them. So, you know, it puts a lot of these things into perspective, especially our techie ego. You know?
Yeah.
Realize, I mean, I love working with pre-sales. You know, the best part of my job is when I'm showing something to the customer and the customer tells me, well, this is exactly what I need.
Yeah.
But it means I did everything right. You know, I heard what they needed, you know, and if I do it in an easy way for me, if it doesn't generate like a humongous amount of work, then it's even better, you know, because I'm being efficient and I'm giving the customer what they want.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You did say something a little bit earlier, if I can like sort of circle back around to that, which I really like because I think about this very often, which is as part of from what I could hear and what conversations you and I have had, there's a huge chunk of your day-to-day work with customers that is around architecting and helping them design the solution. So the way it was at VMware is I felt like my role was to design an architect to a point where the customer can actually see that this is something for them. Not the final official one that's actually going to be implemented because that was professional services, right? Because they were the people who knew all of the nuances and all the, I had a list of prerequisites, but they knew all of them by heart. And what are the potential stumbling blocks that you need to consider as you are designing a complex solution in infrastructure, right? Because there's so many moving parts and so many dependencies that it's haywiring. So really, I find it very, very interesting that as I'm listening to you as well, I think we have the habit of blending those roles a little bit between pre-sales, purely pre-sales, aka the person coming in demonstrating, having conversations, and architect/design person. And do you think Definitely. That's uniquely to us in infrastructure, or do you think that is more towards SaaS as well?
I wouldn't be able to have an opinion on SaaS specifically, because I think from the perspective of I have one SaaS product in my portfolio,
yep.
the architecting part of it is very different, right? When you work with an infrastructure product, I think you get a lot more hands-on on customizing the solution for your customer. While in SaaS, you have things kind of pre-packaged, right? So you're just going to see like if it's small, medium, or large size for the customer.
Yeah. My solution was exactly the same. Like the SaaS product I was selling was practically like, yeah, you know, how many hosts are you using? Yeah, you need an extra large. Fantastic. There's the package. Just install it. Let it run. You know, make sure that all these ports are open. Good to go. And right. Exactly, it was about that level of intricacies. And apologies, I may have pushed you like a little bit of a uncomfortable situation. Like, oh yeah, compare something that you're not very, very familiar with, something you're very familiar with. But just from... I guess also from what we're listening and hearing from our colleagues within the SaaS space, and to your point about even some of the training and the things we're hearing, there isn't really a lot of conversations there around, but then how do you balance this from, you know, wanting to sit down and architect everything and have a finished design sent to the customer? When is your stopping point? Like at one point do you say, no, this is not professional services? Exactly. I don't hear a lot of conversations on that topic.
I don't hear them either. And I think, you know, there's so many of us out there, like infrastructure pre-sales people, yay. But I think that a lot of what we see online or in the communities, the pre-sales communities, are quite not focused on us, right? I think that you're completely right. There's this blend of between like a pre-sales person and an architect when you do infrastructure pre-sales. And, you know, I think there are so many different levels because I'm a frontline SE, right? So I'm the one on the street going with my AE and, you know, just knocking on doors and you know, designing solutions. But I do like more, let's say, high-level work. If I need help, if I need an expert, I have a team of experts that can back me up. And they're SEs too.
Yeah.
If I need to do an architecture. Yeah. So we have like, at Commvault, we have different levels of SEs. So for each of part of the portfolio, we have, a team of SEs that can help. So if I need to go very much deep in a technology or an architecture or whatever, I can count on somebody that has more technical knowledge than I do.
That's very interesting to hear, because VMware had a very similar structure, right? So we had the core team that was the special, like they knew all of the products to a certain level. And then you had the specialist, which I was a part of. So for example, like I had a subgroup of then networking security products that this was then my specialty. And like when I heard you say this, it's like, oh yeah, like I know the specialist because I was one of them in a different world. But yeah.
Yeah. So I think that I would say that I would have a more, like my role would be more on pre-sales and a bit of an architect. I can do like simpler architectures by myself, but like on bigger projects, I usually need like a validation from an expert, which is great for me because if I make a mistake, I have somebody else backing me up. But for example, I've been in a situation recently with a customer that it's a very strategic project, and the people that would be attending some demos we had to do were very, very technical. So I took an expert with me, but I actually prepared the demo using a methodology to go through. Because if I let this guy go by himself, he's going to go into the rabbit hole and the customer is going to be bored. I need to sell. So we prepared together like how our demo is going to look like. We prepared like pauses and times for questions and what we're going to say, what are the benefits we're going to convey, what do we want to show, how we want to show it. We rehearsed it and it went so smoothly with the customer. And all the questions that we wanted the customer to ask, the customer asked, and it just helped us reinforce like the messaging that we were trying to bring through these demos. So these guys, for example, they're more like experts in their parts of the portfolio. Mm-hmm. And they sometimes might lack some of pre-sales skills, right? And that's where I come to help. We help each other. So it doesn't mean that because I don't have that such a deep knowledge on a specific feature or tool within my portfolio, it doesn't mean that I'm less than the guy who knows it all, you know?
Yeah,
we
absolutely
can complement each other because I have skills that they don't have, right?
Yeah. And you displayed it in that example exactly, like where whilst you allow them to focus on the things that they're best at, which is again going in a little bit deeper, going into like, you know, specifically that product set so they can nerd out as much as they want. But you're there to guide the conversation in an effective way, which I think to a certain degree, and again, it's really funny to hear you say this as concerning like another specialist, because I feel, and to the point of like, you know, my journey throughout VMware, I saw that in my colleagues. My colleagues were like that. And they were absolutely fantastic, right? Not all of them. And there were like clear exceptions that I then learned the most from. But all of them were so deeply technical and understood the product so well that, as you said, like they get lost a little bit in their own world. It's like, oh, this is their whole world. And like it took me a lot of time to sort of realize, it's like, okay, what are the points of this product? What are the unique selling features of this product that I need to focus in with this customer, whilst I know this product by heart and I adore it, and all of the features I think are absolutely amazing, but really for this subset of customers that I'm working with, you know, in a specific scenario, not all of them apply. So I need to shut my gob and not tell them about everything, even though my heart is telling me like, tell them everything, tell them about the monitoring.
Look at this cool blue button. They have to know about it.
Yeah. Do they know that they can do timed rules? It's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I know it's cool. It's just, it doesn't matter. Yeah, no, it took a lot of training myself, really.
I know. Yeah. I mean, and today I know very clearly that I love, like I said, I love pre-sales. And I tell this to my manager as well. I don't know if I want to be a specialist in that level because I like being on the front line, going in the street with my AE and, you know, bringing projects to bringing new projects in. If you look at, I think you probably have seen like those charts with the sales cycle and where the pre-sales comes in and when it goes back to sales. I see that has different levels now because you have like the sales cycle, you have where pre-sales comes in, and then you have when your expert comes in and maybe you have a POC. I usually run POCs with a professional services counterpart. Because again, it's infrastructure. A POC in infrastructure is always a nightmare. So I want to bring somebody who's installing and troubleshooting the product every day. My specialist pre-sales counterpart, they don't do that either. I don't do that. They don't do that. But the professional services guy does it, you know? So I usually bring a professional services person with me to POCs. I manage the POCs. I make sure that we're not getting lost in the tests. You know, you do a little bit of a project manager role there, because your objective is to show the customer that what they want to test is feasible. We do it the way they want it, and we get the technical validation there, which is something that with SaaS, it's probably much easier to like let the customer play a little bit with the product. When we talk about infrastructure, it's always, always complex.
Yeah.
I have to say, I hate POCs.
But I'm so happy you mentioned it. Yeah, yeah.
They are so important. You know, we can't run away from them.
Yeah. Well, we say that, but a huge chunk of my role was practically POC avoidance. So
I know.
And from where we stood, especially when it comes to security product, right? Where like there's so many, we can mess up so much in the POC if it's not locked down enough, if it's not a testing environment. I have to tell you the story because I think it's amazing. Like I had a customer who had a really good relationship with that team. They had a moment. So they had one of the products in, the one that actually could lock down, you know, traffic flow and everything else, which was like really important. And I knew they had installed it in their actual ongoing infrastructure. And as I was explaining things to them, I was talking to them about like the two main security rules that I think everyone had to have in place. One that allows everything in case you change something and suddenly nothing works, and one that denies everything in case there is an ongoing cyber attack. So you just like lock down all the doors. Like it's the emergency button. So those two buttons, I think, should always have been in place. But I hope you never have to press the one that says like lock everything. I didn't know that they have installed the actual application in a test environment because it looked exactly like their usual environment, right? Because I could see on the screen, because like they were sharing their screen with me, they like logged in the same way that I was expecting from their, you know, live environment, everything. And they were putting in those two, and I could see that the rule that was saying like block everything was going to be enabled, aka was actually going to become enforceable. And for a moment, my heart, like I was just, and I started just saying like, no, don't do. And like his mouse was hovering over the commit button, which meant like the rule was actually going to be enforced. And I'm like, please don't do that. And like my face was going pale, and he clicked it. And I could feel like all of the blood just disappeared from my body. Like I just brought down a hospital. It was a healthcare customer, right? So I was just like, oh my God, like people are going to die, right? I couldn't find my voice anymore. God, I was so scared. And then they started laughing and they're like, oh, you should see the look on your face. Are you joking? And he was like, oh no,
that's
a test.
That's a really mean prank.
And I'm like, oh, please don't do that. And like one of the guys, he said like, oh, I genuinely thought you knew this was test environment. Like, I'm like, no, you didn't tell me. I got so angry at them, like as my customers. I was just like, I hate you all. Like, I don't want to talk to you anymore. I need to go like have a walk now.
That's a good reason to avoid POCs, you know, like not to have some jump scares like that. It's always so complicated to touch a customer's environment, right? And
yeah,
when you
no.
do infrastructure, even if it's a test environment, you're going to have to put your hand in an environment that is not yours. You have no control in, and anything can happen. Every product has a settle down phase. And sometimes you don't have that time in the POC, and that could actually sink your deal.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely.
Because it's a very, it's a highly technical sale, right? The infrastructure sale is very, very technical. A lot of the times the customer wants to play with it in their environment, and there's no way around it. You can offer them like, oh, you can use my demo environment here. It's going to be just like it was yours. No, I want to put it online. I want to test with my stuff.
Yeah, yeah. To your point that there isn't a lot of material out there about like particular infrastructure pre-sales. And I think I've mentioned before as well on the podcast that I do try to have POC avoidance. The way we did that at VMware was, and for folks listening as well, we had a couple of like sort of points of contact where it was always the assumption of like, if we do these things, there is a high chance that we can avoid a POC. One was obviously best practices when it comes to demoing. When you are demoing something, you know, always circle back around to what is the value, how you're solving specifically the problem they have, what is, you know, don't, it's sort of like leading the witness to a point where don't think about the features and functions too much. Think about like what is the problem, and teach your technical customers as well to think in that sort of way, right? So when we're talking about buyer enablement, that was really my first sort of like big test of that theory of like, can I make these techies, who all of them are techies, think about like, what does your manager want? What is the, you know, while I was talking about healthcare, what does the director of this hospital care about, right? Think about that, less so about what is the function, the feature, and where do you press this button exactly to do it? Whilst I'm not, obviously, and in those two conversations, I always highlighted, like, I'm not ignoring the people actually on this call that will then be using the product. But these are two different conversations that we're having. One is about what is the value of this product, which also you guys are part of this decision making, but also then, like, what does the day-to-day look like? And then, and to be honest with you, the value was easier to, because, you know, again, then you can use all of the tips and tricks and that we have within pre-sales to actually have those conversations, constantly circling around, like, what is the problem? What is the problem that you're solving? What is the problem that you're solving? This is the value, not the feature. But I also had to convince these guys, right? I had to convince the technical guys that this is going to be easy for their day-to-day. And the way we were doing that is we had experience days. So we would bring in people from all around, be it, because I was covering public sector. So I had customers showing up from, you know, universities, hospitals, local councils, bringing them all in together in a room, having these deeply technical conversations and enablement sessions. Plus they got hands-on experience with the product, right? So they can actually see the UI, they can click the buttons, they can go through the process of what does it look like. And then many, many conversations about how does this product exactly is going to fit within them, theirs. And it was less about, oh, I need to see it within my own environment. It was more about, I want you, Lydia, the person that now after so many conversations and in-person meetings and design sessions, I now trust that understands my environment to a degree that I can listen to you and say like, yeah, I understand what you mean. I trust your judgment on this point. For them to then to go, okay, with all of this experience combined, we're happy to take the leap. Because to your point as well, you know, it needs sort of infrastructure solutions. They need time to settle. They need time to grow as well within the environment. And you know, you are as well within the security space. Start small, right? So start with like, what is the most critical point? What is the most critical data? What is the most critical part of an infrastructure that needs to be secured or needs to be changed or optimized or whatever your product of choice is actually doing? And focus on that small part and say, like, you don't have to buy it all. You don't have to, like, buy everything all at once. This also, by the way, applies for hardware as well. A small hardware sale is much easier than a big hardware sale. So if you want to try, like, if you're a Palo Alto, a firewall, Fortinet, if you're a security company that sells, you know, physical firewalls, start with one, two, three maybe, right? And tell them, like, put this in front of the things that are the most valuable. And let's start from there. And then expand and you know, continue going forward. And I think so you know, to summarize, now we're talking about divide the conversation between value and talking to the techies. When talking to the techies and within value, use all of the pre-sales tips and tricks that we talk about within the space. When we're talking to techies, then we're talking about experience days, giving them hands-on access and access to other people that are on this journey as well. Become truly, and I know it's a used up phrase, but truly become their trusted advisor. Sit down with them, sit in the basements of sometimes of yeah, offices yep. with them, with a whiteboard, and just let them talk you through what are their challenges. Give them as much information as you physically can, but always remind them that the best way really is to for them to try the product on a smaller scale.
Yep.
And to yeah, me, that, to me, that so was true. That was revolutionary. That changed my entire pre-sales career.
Using use cases, using other customers as references, all of these are tools that you can use to actually prove your point or prove your solution. You know, a customer, well, I have this customer that they're in the same business as you are, and they have these challenges that are very similar to yours. They managed to achieve this, this, and that using our solution. You want to talk to them. If you have that opening with another customer, you know, use those use cases because they're really, really powerful. And that can save you the possibility of running a POC. The thing for me and what sometimes really annoys me is that talking about data protection, if a customer wants to just test backup and restore, we can do it in a demo. We can do it in a lab environment. I can give you my console. Just use, you can back up and restore. A good POC for me, like talking about data protection, or now we call it cyber resiliency, which is very, very close to security, is I had a project recently that a customer wanted to test a specific functionality from a security standpoint. So they set up an environment, they invited an external consultant, and they took their preferred cyber resilience companies to come in, put their product there, and go through a batch of tests. That's a POC that has clear goals, metrics, and you get like start. That POC was done in 2 to 3 weeks, which in infrastructure is great, because we know that POCs in infrastructure can go on for months and months. That's the kind of POC I like, because then I can actually defend my product and say, hey, and this is important for you. We managed to prove that we can give you this value, and we proved it technically with an external consultant. That's great. Everybody's happy. Give me the deal. But it's a way to get your technical win in a meaningful way, like making POCs meaningful, right? Sometimes they are necessary and they're valid. Most of the times you can avoid them. Or you can actually do what the techie wants without having to go through the whole POC hassle.
Yep. No, completely agree. And also to another point, I think for us within infrastructure, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, that trust is so key. And maybe that's also where a little bit of that techie ego comes in as well, and why it's so hard for us to shake it off. Because it feels like, oh, I need to prove myself to this person that I know enough for them to trust me. But it genuinely, like in my own experience, it is most of the time just genuinely listening to them because they're not used to it. Unfortunately, like that was some of the feedback that I got from my own customers, which is, you know, it's so rare to have a vendor come in and be very honest as well about the shortcomings of a product. Not in the sense of like coming into a call and going like, oh yeah, like my product sucks in these 20 different points. But it's about being very blunt and honest about things of like, hey, you guys want to do this? Like in my case, it was always about connecting it with the hardware world, right? So my security solution was software only. It was within the VMware ecosystem. It's like, guys, like you are running VMware. This is where this product is best. Does it have this function? Because like they would read like the data sheet, for example, and they would go like, oh, but it does like, you know, it can run like on a physical server and can do physical security. Guys, there is a better solution out there for physical security. I can point to them. I can say like, yep, that product and that product and that product are better than my product in this space. So please go ahead and have a chat with them on that side. For me, what I'm talking about and what this product is the best at is within this space. And I would encourage you not to mix and match and not try to like do everything together. Me saying those words to customers was like magic, because suddenly they realized I wasn't just there for the sake of like, oh, I want to sell you everything. Because obviously, like if I sold them also that license, I would make, like, you know, my account manager and I would make a lot more money. But that wasn't the point. The point was the product to work. That was my goal. Yeah. And again, that's how actionably you can become a trusted advisor and not just a buzzword that we use within pre-sales. We're talking about different people within pre-sales. And I like that idea because there is, I think, and people can judge me for this, I do think there is a specific stereotype within infrastructure, especially within infrastructure pre-sales. To Amanda's point, people who are coming in and they know it all and they are amazing technically, maybe so like more lacking on the social side, not having focus on the social side, because I genuinely believe most people can learn these skills. It's not, you know, you're not born with it, but there's definitely a stereotype of that. And I think that's also quite heavily, I wouldn't say enforced, but also it's definitely not helped by the fact that there is genuinely, if we say that pre-sales is generally not particularly diverse, I think infrastructure pre-sales,
oh my God, yeah,
it's even less. It's so even worse. I don't know the numbers. I don't want to know the number.
It's just going to be depressing.
It's not great. It's not great for the longest of time. Like within great. Even within VMware, which is VMware was an incredibly diverse company. I was the only woman and one of two foreigners. So
well, you're one of the three other ladies that are part of the pre-sales team worldwide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting place to be, but I think there's always a conversation around diversity, right? Because it is an important topic. But I think, and obviously we've spoken offline from, you know, offline, online, but all the podcast, we're spoken about like, you know, how do we approach diversity within pre-sales and even more so within infrastructure pre-sales. And I think there's a momentum that I'm not particularly agreeable with of just saying, just shouting at the clouds and saying like, oh, we need more women in this space. It's like, okay, do something about it, right? Don't just say we need them.
Yeah. Like, what are we actually doing to bring not just women, but like recognizing other minorized groups within pre-sales? I know I've worked with people that are part of the LGBT collective that are in pre-sales, and they're in their workday, they're in the closet because they're scared to come out. They're actually scared to be their authentic selves because they're going to hear jokes, or, you know, people are not going to trust them, or they're not going to treat them the same, or they're going to think that they're not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that we always talked about, Lydia, how, like, we as women, we've done that a lot, you know, within our careers, which is like to do much more than we're asked to do, just to show that we actually can. Oh, and this is unconscious bias, right? Because people, and even women ourselves, we think less of other women, or we think less of people from other minorized groups or from a specific ethnicity, or that have a specific accent, or and that requires some internal review and deconstruction of these biases, because that effectively not allows people to be who they actually are in the place where they spent most of the hours in their day.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. It made me really sad now to hear you say, like, the fact, especially folks within the LGBTQ plus community, that they're not able to be their authentic selves. And yet, in the same breath, we talk about, oh, but for to be a trusted advisor, you need to be authentically yourself. So suddenly you're cutting out like a staggeringly large group of people, because to your point, like, they're not being able to bring their authentic selves. Even on that point, like, you know, and we can hear this all the time, like, you know, you should bring your authentic self to work. Let's be very honest and clear. Like, you're never going to be the same person you are at work that you are at home, but you should be given the ability to be the parts of yourself that you want to present at work without feeling the need, not worrying about being judged. And I don't mind sharing my story about this. So my biggest challenge was coming into VMware, which, again, incredibly welcoming environment. Yet at the same time, because I didn't have anyone else to compare to, I was comparing myself to my colleagues. And they were all incredibly professional, incredibly, I wouldn't call them serious, because obviously they had the sense of humor and they were able to, like, create a fantastic relationship with their customers. But it was a specific stereotype, right? It was that level of person coming in with authority, a specific type of jokes that was not native to me, because I'm you know, coming into the UK, I'm not from the UK. And I tried so desperately to emulate that and to imitate that. I genuinely, like, and this sounds so sad, I had a list, Amanda, of all the jokes that my British colleagues would use that I'm like, okay, I need to do this too, right? Because I need to fit in. I need to, like, pretend that I'm from the UK, because otherwise people will snip me out and that I'm a fake.
You know what? And sometimes in doing that, you're actually hurting people that are just like you, like immigrants or women or...
It took me so long to turn around and go and say, like, no, I will be my bubbly self. I will say it out loud that I'm not a native English speaker, you know, so that people should expect that if I say something funny, it's like, no, genuinely, this is just the level of English I have. Like, this is just what I think is supposed to be said here. I'm not just, you know, being weird, or I don't know what I'm saying. It's just I'm translating from another language potentially. And all of these things, and I know my colleagues meant well, but, you know, sometimes, like, I would get the comment of, like, you know, oh, you sound, your English is better than ours. You know, native English speakers would say that to me. And I'm like, well, that, first of all, that's not true. But secondly, like, then I feel like I have no excuse for not being perfect. And to your point, then again, my own level of self-expectation becomes even higher. It's like, okay, so I need to keep on being better. I need to be perfect at this, because otherwise... Now I'm also betraying this idea. And it's really hard to sort of straddle that until you sort of just acknowledge and be okay with the fact. But that takes so much time, and especially, you know, young people coming into this career. You know, I think they, you know I struggled, and I know other people struggle as well. It's like, but how can I be myself at work when they expect me to be this and this and this? It's like, well, there is a level of expectation. There is a level of professionalism that you need to have. But do you not need to be bubbly? I disagree. Would everyone like you? Most definitely not. Is that bad? No. Not really.
No, I think that things that need to change in companies. Like, I had a similar experience to you. I've never lived in the UK, but I worked remotely for the UK for like 3.5 years. And there were some people in the leadership team when I was being considered to work for this team that were like, well, Amanda's good, but she's, you know, she has a weird accent. She's not from here. The customers are not going to accept her. People in the leadership team were actually putting these obstacles in front of me, like as a reason for me not to be part of that team. And at that time, my manager, he like really insisted and said, no, she can do it. She, you know, I speak English since I was 6 years old. You know, it is, I'm not like a native speaker, but I've been speaking English since I was a child. Like, it's ingrained in my brain. I just started working and doing what I do, and I started bringing projects in, and I got along very well with my AEs, and I was bringing in really, really great results. I'm not an exception. There are other people out there that have a weird accent that can deliver the same kind of quality as I could at the time. But the fact that you have to fight to be part of that team, maybe for someone else that could be discouraging. Maybe that person would say, well, yeah, I can't work with the UK because they're not going to accept me. When for me, my experience, especially with the customers, was completely the other way around.
Yeah. Because you were interesting, because you were different in a good way. Exactly. That was my experience as well. It's like once I allowed myself to be one, you know, again, I also like my accent is strange and unique. And then also you have, you know, the fact that I do have a different personality than most of my colleagues would. I allowed myself to have the personality. And that's how people remember you. And in pre-sales, that is so important. Because if you have 20 carbon copies of different, you know, people representing 20 different vendors, but then you have an Amanda coming in with her different accent, with her different cadence, with a different background, with a different perspective, that is much more memorable. Then, and apologies for anyone called this way, but, you know, from the Tims and from the Steves and from the Johns, you know, that are in that case. And, you know, and I do mean this also in, I highlight this for a reason, is because also for Tims and Johns and Steves, you also have a capability, a characteristic that is different from the other John on the call. Showcase that. Allow yourself to be unique and different in a way that is memorable. Because there's nothing better in this role, especially when it's a people-facing role, than to be memorable. Because they will remember you, and they will remember the product. They might not remember how the product is called, but they will remember, oh yeah, John with that really interesting like take that he had on whatever, or that, you know, the personality that shined through. Amazing. Have a funny background. Whatever it is that is true to you, should be allowed and should be encouraged, versus just saying, oh, we need to fill the quota. And that is my biggest challenge, because you're trying to, at the moment, a lot of the solutions we're seeing around, oh, we need more diverse, you know, people within this space. Okay, great. So what do? We put a quota. We put a metric. We say like, oh, we need 50-50. Okay, so let's bring some people in. And then these people are coming in with different expectations or different approaches to this, which is does not fit the mold. It's like, okay, so we brought them in, yet nothing changed. It's like, yeah, because the different people you brought in, you shove them through the same mold that you shove everyone else through, and surprise, surprise, no change happens. Who would have expected?
Exactly. That's so important, Lydia. I don't want to be segregated. I want to be part of the team the way that I am, you know, like being a girl, being South American, having a weird accent, you know, like I do have a weird accent in Spanish as well, you know, and it works fine for me. I've been in Spain for 6 years, you know, and customers understand me, I understand them, and I'm selling. But I don't want to feel like I'm special in my team or that I need special attention. I think that the whole point of this is getting people aware that it's okay to be different first. And we need to start breaking those biases. We need to start seeing people for what they are, which is they're people. Devil is always in the details. I am, my family, you know, my husband is a stay-at-home dad. And I've heard from a previous manager, like, so what does your husband do at home all day? And I was like,
what doesn't he do?
Are you seriously asking me this? You know, like, he does a lot. He does the laundry, he cooks, he takes care of my daughter. What do you want to know? Like, why are you asking me this? Yeah. Like, if I was a man, that wouldn't be a question.
No.
You know?
No, it wouldn't be. To a certain degree, And I know like you did respond in this way, and it's a fantastic way to respond, because that's exactly what we should be doing. We should be challenging these biases in a constructive, friendly way, obviously, not just, you know, taking our bras off and starting to shout at the people that, you know, you should be,
which,
you know, you
which, should be doing... It was what I wanted to do, like, and
no, fair
like,
enough.
Hanging with it, you know.
So many times.
That wouldn't be very good for my career.
Potentially not. It would definitely make an interesting story, but maybe not fantastic for your career. Try a rope. A rope would be more agnostic. But it is genuinely, and I think, because I know I've spoken on other podcasts as well on the topic, and there's so much fear. I remember talking to Mark Green and Adam Vreeman about this, and just the amount of tension that the guys had talking to me about this. And I'm just sitting there going like, is this supposed to be a bad topic that we are talking about? Right? Why is this such a taboo topic to talk about? I am a woman. That's not going to change, right? Like, I'm not planning on changing that, nor do I feel the need to change that. So why does this fact concern you so much? It should be a topic. We should talk about it, right? Again, to the point about breaking biases. But why are we so afraid of acknowledging the fact that, one, we are different? Yes, that's a good thing. We should encourage differences versus just saying like, oh, we're looking for the exact same candidate, you know, 20 times over. And also that fundamental fear of like, oh, but what if I say the wrong thing? What if I misspeak? What if I use guys instead of, you know, hello, everybody? You know, I say hello, guys. It's like, oh, is that going to be offensive to someone? Potentially it can be. But if people want to be offended, they will find offense in every word you say. It's always about what are you as a person intending to do with that? Your intentions are more important than the actual result in that case. And if your intention was to hurt someone, you can say the most mundane things and it would hurt them. To the point, you know, if you wanted to be hurt by that comment and that question, you could have absolutely been hurt. And, you know, instead of, you decided to educate in a nonviolent way. Which,
you know,
is,
I think,
then,
that if people are tense, you know, if they're nervous about, you know, having diversity in their teams, they should go study about it. If you feel tense, try to put yourself in other people's shoes. Try to understand. It's okay. Like, the world is changing. It's okay to change, and things change. I've changed. You know, like you said, I used to reproduce a lot of these behaviors throughout my life, like belittling women or having unconscious bias about certain groups of people. It's okay. We are deconstructing this concept. You know, if you feel uncomfortable or nervous, call me for a coffee. You know? I'll be happy to have a friendly conversation about it. But, you know, it's important
that you acknowledge it.
That's the first step. But if we keep ignoring it, like, it's something like, it's when you see that typical leadership team picture, when all of the people in the picture are middle-aged white men. When you have that picture, that's the definition of a glass ceiling. There is a point that we can go up as women, as people of color, as being able to recognize that. It's already a huge step, because in a few years, not many years, in a few years, that would have just been normal. That's the norm. That's okay. You know, that's how things are. And today we can look at it and say, hey, there's something wrong with this picture. And that brings us to a reflection. What can I, Amanda, or you, Lydia, or you, John, do differently to make people feel included? Like I said, I don't want to feel segregated. I don't want to be put in the spot like, oh, this is the girl in our team.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I just want to be part of the team. Like,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's, again, to my earliest point, it's not about like, oh, we need to get a person of color in a leadership. We need to get a woman in leadership. Otherwise, we look bad. Which is, again, the automatic response. It's going to be a gradual process, but it's about acknowledging it internally, maybe. You know, you don't have to say it externally. You don't have to like state, you know, oh, we're changing this, you know, for the sake of diversity. Like, don't. Actions speak louder than words. You don't need to say anything. Just slowly but surely, as an organization, started looking at those biases, which, by the way, and I do want to acknowledge this because it's really important, it is completely normal to have these biases. It is natural. We're tribalist by nature. We tend to be around the people that look like us, that sound like us, that act like us. This is the natural tendency we have as people. Studies, you know, multiple studies have shown that a diverse team of people, especially in a social environment such as pre-sales, is incredibly beneficial for, at the end of the day, you know, what most businesses care for, which is making more money. You make more money by bringing in a diverse set of people in the right way, very important caveat, which is not about just like, you know, if we put a metric on it, we're going to get more people in, we're going to make more money. Not as easy as that. I wish it was, you know, no magic wand here. It is about having a cultural change and a cultural shift of having that this is just now the norm that we have here in this team. And that is a huge challenge that we're seeing. And same point as you, Amanda, I don't like the fact that the tendency then is like, we need to create a space for these people. Like, that's a given. They will create the space by themselves. All of your female colleagues most likely have a chat that they're just talking between themselves and you have no idea about. Most of your people, you know, people of color within your team, they also have a chat. Most people from the same country, guarantee they will have a chat that is not, you know, part of the... They will do that themselves. You don't need to say we have a female pre-sales group, you know, over here on the side having conversations about female pre-sales things. It's like, no, we need to be part of the broader conversation if there is to get those benefits.
It has been done to us for so many years, you know, let the girls have their girl talk.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly. Yeah. Especially in tech, right? This is a very common thing in tech. And one last thing I wanted to have a conversation with you about, which was like, it's such a staggering thing. Because you mentioned something like, you know, we're not unique, right? We're not the exception to the rule of like, you know, oh, you know, you have like techie women in pre-sales, or you have like techie women overall. Like, you know, oh, you're such an exception. There are a couple of points there that are quite challenging, because even such like such a positive comment that I've heard from people is like, whenever I talk about my challenges or my concerns about like my networking career. So this was even back then. And they would say like, oh, but what, some of the most, like the best networking people I know are women. It's like, okay, you are now, again, reiterating this concern I have that I need to be the best to be a woman in network engineering. You're not, exactly. I know, I understand your intention. They are good intentions, but that should be a deeper, and again, at the time, I was 20, 21, 22. Like, I didn't know for myself that that was not what I needed. You know, I needed to have that conversation about like, buddy, I hear you, but this is my actual concern. It's like, this is like exactly what you just said is my concern, that I'm not going to be good enough to be one of the best, but also a woman. Right. So that should not be even the conversation.
Pressure, right?
It is. It's an incredible amount of pressure. But also then you have like this sort of, again, you're stereotyping people that say like, you know, oh, women in this space are so good. And then how does that translate to people who are trying to get into pre-sales? And I'm talking about women in particular here, but it's, you know, for all minorities, is that then you're talking, you know, we suddenly become, unfortunately, a negative power in this space, where it's like, oh, to be in pre-sales, like you need to be outspoken like Lydia Amanda, or you need to have like a really bubbly personality, or you need to be super techie, otherwise it doesn't work. Lydia University would listen to this and she would say, well, that's not the space for me then.
Exactly.
And that is so staggeringly sad, because you don't have to be like me, or you don't have to be like Amanda for this to be the space for you. Yeah. You don't.
Honestly, I'm happy you touched on that, because that's where allyship comes in. That is so important, because when you do that exercise of, you know, identifying your biases, identifying like when you see a microaggression, actually identify it, you know, and you as probably a person that is not part of one of these groups, or you're part of one group but not part of the other, that's when you can step up and try to give a hand to that person, or it can help you on your own process, you know. Maybe if you're a manager, maybe try to make your team more diverse at the same time that everybody feels included. We have, like you said, the quota. I think that managers can be great allies. And I've been fortunate enough to have managers and mentors who are great allies. Like they're white males, and they have been allies, and they have been in this deconstruction process and learning and asking questions and just trying to make things different, you know. It's really heartbreaking when, you know, for example, you have somebody in your team that has, you know, a certain sexual orientation, and they can't express that, because people talk, right? In your team, I have a husband, I have a kid, I don't have kids, but I have a partner. And you always see that person just quiet because they can't express who they are. It's like the silliest things. How are you going to build that trust relationship when that person can't be themselves? And that coming from the colleagues, the managers, the mentors, giving the space for that person to feel comfortable enough to say, yeah, I'm actually married to a guy and we have a dog, you know, whatever. Yeah. You know, I'm a gay man married to another man and we're happy, and that's what it is, you know. that's fine. You know, like it's really heartbreaking when you see somebody that has to like pretend they're something they're not. And they say that because for women nowadays, it's gotten a lot better. You know, when I started like 20 years ago, like I had a customer ask me if my dad knew I was in that meeting, you know. So I have countless situations. I can tell countless stories. But nowadays, it's been different. But not only like you suffer those, well, us as women, we used to suffer those microaggressions. We also didn't have people that would actually help us, you know, feel comfortable in our own skin. And we would make jokes about other women. I've been there. I've done it. I'm not proud of it. But that's part of my, you know, growth as a human being. So allyship is so important. If you're in a position of privilege because of who you are, try to, you know, lean a hand to somebody who isn't. Try to make them feel comfortable. Because I bet that for you, Lydia, if you didn't feel comfortable enough to be bubbly and who you are, you might have shut down.
I don't think I would have made it in pre-sales. I'll be honest with you. I think I would have like thrown in the towel after, because like, it was a hard like learning curve. Like I just couldn't see myself doing that. I was going to go back to being a network engineer, right? I just, you know, and I wouldn't have done all of the things I've already done. And I would have, you know, I wouldn't have known what I could have done, right? But it would have been regretful, right? It's just like this amazing career and this amazing community that I have of people. It would have been completely lost to me. But I think that the topic of allyship is it's important. And that's why, to the point about like separating, and we do it to ourselves, like we separate ourselves into a different room. It shouldn't be a different room. And it shouldn't be just talking about like, you know, purely either, you know, women topics or purely LGBTQ plus topics or purely ethnicity topics. It's always about like, you know, how can we as people help each other out? So especially when it comes to allyship, and by the way, same as you, like most of the mentors I've had, you know, most of the allies I've had throughout my career journey have, again, been your stereotypical pre-sales person. However, whatever that looks like in your mind, those were my people as well, and they're still my people. And I don't see a point where I could have turned around and went like, but actually, no, I would have preferred if you were in a different color. That would have been awful of me. Could you imagine? Like, just because like, oh no, actually, like, you know, I would prefer someone. Like, it's like, no, allyship comes in all shapes and sizes. And a very important point here is also, like, when we're talking about diversity, you don't have to understand, or you don't have to be able to fully put yourself in this other person's shoes. Because if you're someone that, for example, has never left the country, obviously you have been a specific ethnicity your whole life. You have always been a specific, you know, even social group your whole life. That is absolutely fine. You don't have to be able to fully put yourself in other people's shoes, but use your pre-sales like 2 ears and one mouth's mantra and listen more and hear exactly what these people are going through and see in your what is in your power to potentially help. You don't have
it's empathy,
to.
Right? It's all about empathy.
It's all about empathy. And again, very importantly, you don't have to help, but it's about what is the impact you want to have on the world, of on your career, on your workday. And if you think that you not helping is not going to change much, so be it. I would challenge that. Because imagine the team, you know, the people that you, to Amanda's point earlier, you spend at the minimum 8 hours a day with these people, especially if it's someone that you work quite closely to. Imagine how much nicer would it be if you understand a little bit more about their culture, if it's a little bit more about their background, a little bit more about, you know, their relationship they have with you, you know, to the point of like, you know, oh, talking about kids and talking about partners. Like, yeah. That's a life that you don't have potentially. Question. Be curious. Be, you know, don't be afraid of asking these questions. If the person on the other side wants the same thing as you, aka creating a more like a nicer environment to work at, those questions would not be turned down. Quite the opposite. People love talking about themselves.
Of course they do. Maybe you want to know that for an hour or
exactly.
Something.
Yeah. You want to know about my background? Oh, I can't wait to tell you about like post-Soviet Bulgaria. Like it is fantastic, right? And that is how you create a more cohesive team. It's by, again, not you don't have to live and breathe like every single moment, but it's just acknowledging the fact that yes, it's natural to be, you know, to be tribal and to look for other people of your tribe. But in this day and age, for a more effective, more cohesive, more a richer workday, it is beneficial to bring people alongside you with your tribe. Give it a try.
Well, Lydia, we're very good examples of that, right? You're from Bulgaria, all the way from the other side of the world in Brazil. Yeah, here we are. Yeah. And we have our differences in personality and experiences and whatever. We have points that we, a lot of points, I would say, that we converge, even Absolutely. Though we come from different backgrounds and have different experiences and all of that. And that's great. You know?
Thank you so much for listening to this interview with Amanda. As you could tell, I was having a lot of fun talking to her, and it was incredibly refreshing to have this conversation. I will have Amanda back on the podcast, and I would love to dive into a couple of different topics that we didn't have really the time to expand on, and just really also see as a refresh and as an update as where do we stand with all these things. Obviously, my career path has changed a little bit, but the challenges and the other things that we did discuss during this episode, they do still apply. And I would love to hear more from her as well. And hopefully so do you. Please leave us some feedback. Best way to do that is via LinkedIn. You can always get in contact with Amanda herself. As I said, she's an incredibly friendly person to talk to. So I highly, highly recommend you reach out to her as well. Hopefully I also get to see her this year at Demofest London, and which I'm very excited about. If you want to see more of us, please follow the links in the episode description. We are also uploading all of the episodes slowly but surely onto YouTube for folks that do prefer to have that listening experience. Otherwise, you can find more episodes of the Wandering Tech Podcast on your usual places where you find your podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time.